A hot summer day might be the best time to talk about life in one of the coldest places on the planet. Antarctica is the setting of a work of fiction from an Ashland author, a debut novel from Midge Raymond called My Last Continent. It's a recent release on the Scribner imprint. Midge Raymond is the author of a short story collection called Forgetting English. It has received the Spokane Prize for short fiction, and her short work has also appeared in a number of literary publications. Midge has written two books for other writers and is the co-founder of Ashland Creek Press. It was in that role that we first met her last fall, prior to the book and author fair in Ashland. Midge Raymond, thanks for joining us again on The Exchange.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So how exciting is it to get the first novel out there, in a cover, in stores, people looking at it, talking to people about it in stores?
It's wonderful. It's very exciting. I will log into Facebook and see pictures of friends in bookstores across the country, you know, with the book. It's very, very exciting.
Are there, I have to wonder then, and not to push you onto your next work, but are there, does any author have a number of novels in various states of completion lying around?
I imagine they do. This isn't the first novel I've written. It just happens to be the first novel that's being published that I've written. I think most authors have a couple of practice novels under their belts, which makes a lot of sense, good sense. And I'm already thinking, I haven't had much time to write lately, but I have my next project in mind, and I'm eager to get started when the excitement dies down.
So talk about the decision process that goes into that then. I mean, how do you and editor decide? I mean, I imagine you throw a couple of manuscripts in front of the editor and say, well, you know, I like this one. Or did you just say, this is the one that's ready, My Last Continent?
That's a great question, actually. Well, I have... The way it works with Big Five publishers is you have to go through a literary agent. So with the other novels I had, I talked to – this was years in the past. I talked to a few agents about them. I did not have a novel that was ready for a long time. With this novel, I worked on it off and on for many, many years. And I approached an agent whom I really admired, who's just a really wonderful agent in the field. And she does a great job with fiction. And she sent me – actually, the first response I got from her was a wonderful rejection. She's like, this novel is great, but...
And a wonderful rejection. This is the title of a novel all by itself.
Yeah, I know. And well, I love to tell this story because I think writers have to realize how tough this business is and not to be discouraged by rejections because you're going to get a lot of them. I mean, I've been working on novels and I've worked with several agents and, you know, nothing took until I got to this point. And so she sent me a great sort of, well, it's almost there, but this is what I'd love to see. So we kept in touch. I sent her a revision. She loved that. And then went out with it.
So you hear all the time, write what you know. I mean, do you know Antarctica?
I do on some levels, and I think you can write what you know and fill in the rest with research. So that's what I did. I visited Antarctica in 2004, and I was very inspired by what I saw there and very concerned about what I saw there, which led into a short story, which later evolved into the novel. And then I also did some penguin research in Argentina at the Puntatumbo colony.
I noticed that, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was able to get into the mind of a penguin researcher thanks to some of that research and some of the personal hands-on experience, and then also I just supplemented it with as much research as I could find.
I can imagine, given the time it takes to get to Antarctica, there's several days of buildup, but once you actually got to see it for yourself, and I assume you actually walked upon it, what impressions formed in the first day or so?
Well, it's just an incredible place. And you're right, it is a long haul to get there. It's absolutely incredible to be in a spot where no humans live, to be in a place that is completely uninhabited by anyone but its creatures. So that was the first thing. It's just a sense of peace. You know, there's none of the white noise of everyday life. You hear nothing but birds. You hear nothing but penguins and skuas and splashes of seals in the water. It's incredible. It's very peaceful, very quiet, and very otherworldly.
It's just an accident that we're talking to you a few days after we talked to the author of Braving It, which is a father-daughter tale of journeys to rugged Alaska. Going to Antarctica, like going to remote Alaska, is like risking your life. I mean, missteps get you into cold water, not hot water, and you can die fairly fast there.
Absolutely, yeah. And ship, I would do want to say that even though my novel is about a shipwreck, the cruise industry is very, very safe. But as you say, it's an unpredictable place. And so there are certain dangers. One of the things that inspired the novel was the concern of the naturalists that I spoke to. I was there on a small expedition ship of fewer than 100 passengers, which I think is a really great way to go. They were expressing a lot of concern about the bigger cruise ships that were heading down to Antarctica with thousands of passengers. And these cruise ships didn't get close enough to the peninsula to land on the islands. No one really got off the boats, but they, you know, gave passengers a glimpse of the continent. But those ships were so large, and they didn't have reinforced hulls like our ship did. They weren't really prepared for the ice necessarily. And if something were to go wrong in such an unpredictable place, the water's freezing. There's a lot of passengers to be rescued with no rescuers nearby because every location is so remote.
A long way away.
Closest rescuers could be a day away or more. So,
It's not just the danger that tourists, but the danger that tourists present to Antarctica itself. I mean, and very early in the book, a tourist cracks his head open, and there's an interesting procedure that the people go through in trying to clean up where he fell. What is that all about?
Well, when you land on Antarctica, and by landing I mean you get off the boat and set foot on one of the islands or on the continent, you have to sterilize your boots. You can't take anything with you, no food, you know, nothing. You can't drop anything, you know, and passengers do. I mean, I saw it happen, and I remember picking up a Kleenex that someone dropped and stuffing it in my parka because, and you know, it was just, those are the kind of things that could choke penguins or whatever. And those are also germs that they've never been exposed to. They're pretty isolated down there. So great care is taken to make sure that we don't bring any bacteria to the islands and that, you know, we sterilize our boots before getting back on the boat as well so we don't transport, bacteria from one island to another.
Wow. And so in the case of the tourist who cracks his head open, people are actually scooping up the blood into plastic bags?
Yes. I mean, that didn't happen, but that's what would have happened had, you know, something like that happened. I mean, it's like if you got sick on the snow, you would have to, you know, clean up after yourself. And, you know, researchers on the island, they have to pick up everything that they take in with them. So nothing gets left behind.
Constant theme of the book, how humans need to be kind to Antarctica. The novel is called My Last Continent. Midge Raymond of Ashland is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She'll be appearing tonight at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland at 7 o'clock. That is free to the public. And we'll continue our discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Exchange with Midge Raymond and you in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Midge Raymond. She is an Ashland author and publisher and a lot of other things as well, all involved with books. She's the co-founder of Ashland Creek Press, which still keeps her busy, but she's also got a book out on Scribner, her debut novel called My Last Continent. Last Continent, in this case, being Antarctica. It's a love story. It's a penguin story. It's an ecological story. It's a lot of things, all in My Last Continent. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Antarctica and environmental pressures and a lot of things related to that. 800-838-3760. For your questions, your comments, maybe stories of your own about visiting the bottom of the world. 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. This is not the first tourism site, Midge, that a lot of people think of going to Antarctica. As you pointed out, larger cruise ships are going there now. So I mean, how fast are the numbers coming up of people who go there or at least go near there?
Very fast, actually. The very first citizen explorers, as they were called back then, went to Antarctica in 1966, and there were 57 people. Now there are close to 40,000 people. And when I was there in 2004, the numbers were about half that. So it's increasing quite a lot. People are very curious. I think there are more tours than ever. There are a lot of opportunities that tour companies are taking advantage of. And it's getting to be... I wouldn't say it's problematic because it's all very closely regulated, but we have to be sure it stays that way to protect the environment.
When you're talking about the cruise ships that are showing up, we're talking the giganto ones like the Rhapsody of the Seas? I mean, they're basically the hotel on a barge kind of?
There are some like that that do cruise down there to the Southern Ocean.
Wow, that's a lot of cruise ship. And a lot of and not a lot of thick hull, as you point out. It's not a reinforced hull. It's not like there's a cleanup crew that comes behind the tourists. So if they don't police themselves, who makes sure that they're going to in the first place?
Exactly. There is an organization called the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators, known as IATO. And they, it's a voluntary membership organization. And back when I went, the large cruise ships were, not very many of them were members. Most of them are now, which is a good thing. So they regulate themselves. They self-regulate. They have certain rules about how many passengers can land at a time, no more than 100. And any cruise ship carrying more than 500 passengers is not allowed to take them ashore. So they do have rules and guidelines in place. And so that's a great thing. That's a positive thing. But again, there's that unpredictability, and you just have to be really aware of that and be really careful about that.
Is everybody supposed to take everything out with them? Is there supposed to be nothing left behind? I mean, again, it's not like you can have a trash can there and have a sanitation crew come pick it up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are very strict rules about that. And everything has to come back. The fuel has to be, there's a certain grade of fuel that you have to, that the ships that go to Antarctica have to use in case something does happen, so that the impact will be minimal.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. So tourism aside, though, I mean, what is happening to Antarctica with climate change, and how much did that, I mean, it was something that showed up constantly in your research?
Absolutely. The peninsula is among the fastest warming places on the planet. It's warming at about 5 times the global average. So the peninsula is warming very rapidly, and they're starting to see impacts on the animals who live there. And in addition to climate change, overfishing is a big problem in the Southern Ocean. Whaling still happens. It's illegal, but the Japanese are big whalers still in the Southern Ocean. And krill fishing is becoming a big industry, especially in China and Russia. There are 300,000 tons of krill taken from the Antarctic. And that's a lot of whale food, and that's a lot of penguin food, and seal food. So there is a hope that they're hoping to create marine protected areas in Antarctica where there are no take zones whatsoever, which I hope happens, because that would be really, really good for the ecosystem.
The book, again, is called My Last Continent. Midge Raymond is the author. Now, this is it is fiction. I mean, you had to create the main character, Deb Gardner, and it is in first person. So you're speaking through this character. What is it like to go through a book where you're having this person who's got life experiences you didn't have, and trying to speak through this person?
Well, it's a lot of fun. Being a writer is one of those great jobs where you can hear voices in your head and not be locked up for it. You know, it's really a fun process to get into another character's head and live in there for a while. So I had a lot of fun with it. But it was also a challenge because I did have to know things that I don't know, and I had to do a lot of research so that her experiences would feel authentic to me.
She's an intellectual. She's a science nerd devoted to research, a bit sexually impulsive, I think we can fairly say. I mean, do you think the life of a scientist is a little more randy than some of us suspect?
Well, that's a great question. I have no idea. I think for Deb, at least, you know, her life is so random and so unpredictable, and she's certainly been very unlucky in love. So I think that leads to some of the impulsivity, you know, taking opportunities where you have them, and also just not having the stability that a lot of people have, because she's always running down to Antarctica to do more research. And so without that stability, I think that leads to some impulsivity.
As you write a character and write, you know, inner thoughts and actions as well, I mean, are there times when you end up going, wait, no, hang on, that's Midge, you know, hit the delete button and go back and that sort of thing? I mean, does Midge get in there sometimes? Do you have to pull her out?
I think Midge gets in there a little bit, and I think part of the revision process is making sure she disappears completely, definitely.
A fair amount of, your descriptions of the Antarctic are quite vividly drawn. The book really takes place inside Deb's head, and some rocky terrain as well. Without giving away too many of her secrets, how would you describe her to people who would, you know, be meeting her in a sense for the first time, even in a literary sense?
Well, one thing I think is interesting about Deb and about the book and the relationship between Deb and Keller is that Antarctica is sort of a third party in their love triangle. And the thing about Antarctica and Deb also is that Antarctica became so much a character to me as I wrote the book. And she is so synonymous with that continent. You know, she's a little cold emotionally. She's just a little bit icy because of her past, because of her poor luck in relationships. And so I think that parallel is one that can be drawn, just that Deb is sort of embodies the continent in many ways. Remote, chilly, you know, she thaws a bit in the book, I think. But
as you write along, though, I mean, how much of an outline, for example, do you set up in advance, and how much of the stuff are you just writing along going, wow, this is turning in a direction I didn't expect?
Well, for me, and every writer is so different in terms of their process, but if I have an idea of where I'm going, where it'll end, I don't really need too much of an outline. But I do like to have a bit of an outline. I kind of like to have a vague idea of where I'm going, but I don't necessarily stick with it. I like having an idea of, you know, the finish line and what's waiting for me there. But otherwise, I'm happy to explore and see where it takes me.
So sometimes you're sitting there pounding on the keyboard thinking, oh, Deb Gardner, what are you doing?
Absolutely.
Keller Sullivan, you mentioned him. He's talk about the creation of this character.
Well, I wanted this to be a love story, and he's a character who I knew that in order to connect with Deb, he had to have a similar connection to the continent, because that is what she understands most, and that's something that she can get and fall in love with as much as she has with the continent. So in creating his story, without giving too much away, it had to be a story in which he needed to find solace in the continent as much as Deb does. So that's how he came about.
Well, let's talk about the continent. You have a little chunk there that you could read us about life at McMurdo Station.
Sure.
In Antarctica. And we're talking people who spend winters in Antarctica are not going to see the sun for, what, several months at
a
time?
Yes, definitely. And in this little passage, Keller, it's not giving too much away to say that Keller and Deb's relationship is complicated. So in this little passage, it was shortly after they met at McMurdo Station, Keller tells Deb that he is staying behind instead of going back to the U.S. with her. And so this is just a little passage of what Deb is thinking. I want to tell him so many things. That it's exhilarating, the way the sun dips below the horizon for longer and longer each day, a glowing orange yolk that leaves behind a reddish-black sky. That it's lonely, that he will hear the waning sound of the season's last plane echoing in the sky for a long, long time. That it's dangerous, that the storms here, unlike anything he's ever seen, with winds at 100 knots, temperatures at 80 below zero, snow blasting through the air like violent ghosts and seeping into buildings through the smallest cracks imaginable. That in the 6 months of total isolation, with no supply deliveries, no company other than 200 other wintering souls, he will long for things like city streets, oranges, the leaves of trees.
That is Midge Raymond reading from her debut novel, My Last Continent, out on Scribner Books. She'll be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7 o'clock for an hour, and has been on tour with the book for a bit already. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk not just about the book, which you may not have read, but about Antarctica, which you may have heard of and have some thoughts about. Join us on the Exchange with your thoughts, your stories, your own perhaps experiences with the big frozen continent at the bottom of the world. 800-838-3760 to visit by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Some of the phrases really jump out. The season's last plane, the idea of like, well, that's it for a while.
Absolutely. I mean, you're stuck in total darkness, in complete near complete isolation, 200 other people. And as you may have heard, there was recently a rescue from the South Pole Station that was really unusual. You have to be pretty sick to be evacuated at this stage in an overwinter at the South Pole. And it went really well, fortunately. But that's very, very unusual, because usually people just stay isolated for the entire winter.
Now, how far is the pole itself from the edge of the continent?
From the edge of...
It's hundreds of miles.
Oh,
anyway.
Yeah.
It's not thousands?
Yeah, and the South Pole actually moves because it's ice. It's not land. So, mm-hmm. And the South Pole, it's probably the very, very coldest place on Antarctica. The peninsula where most tourists go is pretty temperate, actually.
Uh-huh.
So, but McMurdo Station and the South Pole, they get extremely cold. Like 80 below zero is pretty normal for the winter there.
I have to admit, I'm smiling now because not just because of the way you write about what it's like at McMurdo Station, but because between the time that I read the parts of My Last Continent and got ready for the interview, and now I had a chance to see The Martian over the weekend, and the idea of being marooned in a place where the weather is just miserable and there's nobody else around, it kind of rings true in a bunch of ways now.
Yeah, you have to be a special kind of person to overwinter in Antarctica. And I saw some great documentaries. You know, A Year on Ice was a really, really interesting one. And people who do it love it. They just wouldn't want to be anywhere else, which I think is interesting. And Deb and Keller are very much that way. But it does take a certain type of person. You have to pass all these psychological tests. And it's certainly not for everyone.
I wondered about that. It probably is like training astronauts, in a sense. You're looking for people who are really emotionally resilient and can put stuff behind them and think, okay, well, that didn't work. Let's try the next thing.
Yeah, and absolutely. And you have to be physically healthy as well, just because of you really can't do anything about getting sick, except in very rare instances like the one that just happened at the South Pole Station. But yeah, you have to be in top physical condition. You have to be in top emotional condition.
Let's talk about the scientists in love, Deb and Keller. How would you describe their relationship?
Well, again, I think it's like a love triangle with Antarctica in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. I think they are like the Adélie penguins. They are loyal first and foremost to the continent for various reasons. They each have their own reasons. But they understand that about each other, and they're okay with that. And that's part of what they love and understand about each other.
Well, given their fixation with each other and their fixation with Antarctica, it seems like they're not entirely successful in finding ways to be together.
It's true. They are together mostly down south and very rarely anywhere else. We get a couple of glimpses of them being together stateside, but it's more unusual that they are together here than down south.
Now, in some of the relationships in the book, there's a withholding of information, which might run a little counter to today's world in which we share everything all the time, particularly in a world of social media. Was that a little apart from where you think society is generally now?
I think so. And I think also it just sort of fits in with the idea of isolation in Antarctica. You know, it's really, I think the people who go there and spend their time there, and even people who travel there, they need to get used to not being in touch and to being a little disconnected. And so even in Antarctica, I mean, the ships make a point of having satellite phones if you need them. You can be connected if you want to, but it's not like you can, you know, take out your phone and update your Twitter feed very easily. It's still, you're pretty remote. And when you're down there for a winter, you can talk on the phone, they do have internet, but it's all limited. And so you have to be used to the isolation. And I think parts of the book reflect that a bit. It was
parallels between the physical isolation and the emotional
exactly.
isolation. Okay. From the very first sentence, you do draw parallels and first visual between humans and penguins. Are you deliberately drawing parallels between the relationships that the two creatures have, the mating of the two creatures?
I do, because I think with Deb and Keller, certainly not with any relationship, but with Deb and Keller, it's very much, you know, like the penguins. It's a relationship that's very instinctual in good ways, but also in ways that, you know, keep them from having the perfect relationship, a relationship that most people would think is perfect in terms of being together as often as possible, or knowing exactly what you want and having things settled, having a plan. You know, they have none of that, but they still have a very close bond.
We get three types of penguins at the start. I mean, how different are they from one to the other? You mentioned a couple of Adélie penguins and emperors, and there's at least one other.
And chin straps, mm-hmm. And gentoos, actually. Mm-hmm. So on the peninsula, the three brush-tailed penguins are Adélies, chin straps, and gentoos, and those are the ones most tourists will see. The emperors are much farther south and farther inland, so it's rarer to see them up on the peninsula. The emperors are the huge penguins that we see a lot. They're several feet tall, and they waddle. They keep their arms close to their sides and have that cute little walk. The brush-tailed penguins stick their flippers out when they walk, and so they look a little more comical, whereas the emperors look quite serious. But they are all, I think they're all adorable and amazing. They all look very different. The brush-tailed penguins on the peninsula are all... they're all a little different in their own ways, subtle differences in terms of their breeding habits. They are the two species, gentoos and Adélies, are near threatened, whereas the chin straps are still a species of least concern. So their population is doing pretty well, whereas the gentoos and Adélies are having to adopt quite a bit.
So what are they threatened by in a place so far from regular human habitation?
Well, that's such a great question, and I'm glad that you asked, because it is what we do up here that can affect them so drastically down south. They are affected by climate change mostly, changing of weather patterns. So, for example, if it rains or snows a lot during their breeding season, the chicks will drown in the meltwater. If there is too little ice or too much ice, there has to be a balance, and the balance is constantly being disrupted by climate chaos. You know, they might have too little ice to be able to get out to forage. I mean, they might have too much ice to get out to forage. They might have too little ice to feed the krill that is their food source. So the krill feed on ice, on the plankton that lives underneath the ice. And then, you know, if the krill suffer, then the penguins don't have enough to eat.
Okay, so here again,
it's all connected.
It's all connected, and a very fragile ecosystem.
Yes.
For all of the things that depend on each other for survival, which raises a question we get from Sharon from email. She says, "I've long wanted to go to Antarctica. I wish I could winter there. However, do you think that people shouldn't go unless they have a scientific reason? Short form, how do you feel about Antarctic tourism?"
I think that's such a great question. I'm completely conflicted about it, because I have been, of course, so it would be completely hypocritical for me to say, don't go. But on the other hand, you know, my being there changed my life in so many ways that I think are positive for the environment. I became a big environmentalist in my personal life, and I co-founded a press devoted to environmental literature. So it really changed my life in positive ways. And I've written this novel that I hope will teach people about the continent and sort of help them have the same love for it that I do. So I think if you do go down as a tourist, just try to educate yourself as much as possible and bring something back with you and make it count. I would hate to see people not go down altogether, because it can be a life-changing experience that does the continent a lot of good. But I think we have to be very responsible about it. So for anyone who does go, you know, look into the ship you're going with, make sure it's sustainable, make sure, you know, it's environmentally sound, and that the practices are things that you can agree with.
What kinds of things should they look for in terms of specifics, though, that make a ship sustainable and environmentally sound?
Well, I think how many tourists are on the ship, what kind of educational programs they have. Is it all about education or is it all about entertainment? There's a difference there. Look at where it's registered and what sort of laws they have to abide by. The other thing I think, and this is fun, this is just me, but I was always kind of shocked that they serve seafood on these ships, because, and that's something that the characters argue about in the book, because, you know, overfishing is a problem for the creatures of the Antarctic that you're visiting down there. And yet, you know, so I think it's a conundrum for tour operators who want to serve their passengers the finest food possible, which includes seafood. But at the same time, by feeding people seafood when you're down there talking about overfishing in the Antarctic, it's just kind of funny. So yeah, things like that. I think people listen. I think tour operators listen to what their customers want. And so speaking up about it could make a big difference.
Tourism in Antarctica, one of the many points in My Last Continent, the debut novel from Midge Raymond, now out on Scribner. You can join us on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Midge about the book and about the characters and some of the timelines in the book, which do jump around a bit. We can talk about that, too. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Midge Raymond and My Last Continent and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Midge Raymond, who lives in Ashland, is the co-founder of Ashland Creek Press, and is now out with a debut novel on Scribner called My Last Continent. It's about Antarctica and scientists working in Antarctica and tourists causing pressure to Antarctica and all of its fragile natural systems. Lots going on in My Last Continent. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Antarctica and tourism and penguins and all the other things that go on here. Even if you don't know anything about the characters, there's lots to talk about. We appreciate your sharing at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about the cruise ships and choosing ships that are environmentally sound, maybe don't serve seafood, have smaller passenger manifests, that sort of thing. Now, there has been a cruise ship sinking, and there is. You mentioned that this is about that, so I'm not giving anything away that you haven't already revealed. There is a cruise ship that sinks in here. There has been one in the real world that was a fairly small ship, and all hands were saved. But over time, then, as you're saying, the ships are getting a lot bigger. And I'm surprised the IATO, okay, is allowing the larger ships to get in there?
Well, if they're part of the membership, well, first of all, no one owns Antarctica. No one owns its waters. It is a continent without a government. There is an Antarctic Treaty that protects the continent. It is to be used for peaceful and scientific purposes only. But in terms of tourism, anyone can do whatever they want. So IATO is very important in, you know, having this voluntary membership and having people abide by certain regulations. It's very important. But again, anyone can go down if they'd like. And that's a concern. I sent a copy of the book to one of the naturalists who was on our ship, who, you know, had one of several who were expressing concerns about these big ships. And she said, I still fear that an accident will happen like the one that happens in your novel, only it'll be much worse than what you describe in the book, which actually shocked me, because my book is, well, I thought, a big dramatization of what could happen. But the fact is that people who know Antarctica do worry that this could, in fact, happen. And
oh, you thought you were going
worse.
Really big and really scary.
I thought I was going over the top. But but the fact that they are worried that this could still happen is frightening.
Given your concerns about Antarctica, and you have been there, as you point out, would you go back, or is it the kind of thing where once is enough and you're going to let anybody else have a turn and try to live by your own set of rules, I guess, and not go as much?
That's a great question. I have no plans to go back. I think if I were able to go back to do something really good, you know, some sort of educational thing, I would consider it. But as of now, I don't feel like I need to go back. And it's sad to say, it's one of my favorite places on earth. I mean, it is one of the most exquisitely beautiful places I can ever imagine being. So I would love a chance to go back, but I wouldn't feel right about it. So
you talked about the beauty, and you talked about the silence. And you talked about picking up Kleenexes and stuffing them in your parka. I haven't heard you talk about how cold it was, though. Clearly, the beauty and the silence overwhelmed the impression of coldness. But what did it feel like?
The peninsula is pretty temperate.
Really?
It felt like when I went to Antarctica, I was living in Boston at the time. So I flew out of Boston, and it was January, which is the austral summer down south. It was no colder than Boston in January. It might have been warmer, in fact. We visited Palmer Station, one of the U.S. bases down there, on a day that was 45 degrees Fahrenheit. And we were all bundled up in our parkas because for us that was cold. For me that was cold. But the people who worked at the station were in shirt sleeves, you know, no
wow.
jackets, no scarves or hats. They thought it was summer.
I mean, 45 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty
warm.
Yeah, and that's really not cold. So it's very temperate during the austral summer, which is tourist season. When it's not, the sea ice freezes, the sea freezes, and it becomes impassable. And that's what you have to be careful of. And the further south you go, the more ice is there year-round. So that's the danger if, you know, you have a captain who wants to show you more and takes you further south, like the captain of the Australis does in the novel. That's where you can get into trouble. You can get stuck in ice. It happens all the time. From Ernest Shackleton to, you know, the Russian icebreaker. I think it was in 2013. An icebreaker got stuck there.
Oh, I remember that.
Or
a
research vessel got stuck there. And then the icebreaker that showed up to help it also got stuck there.
Wow. I remember reading a description in a New Yorker piece from somebody who said, you know, you can watch. You can actually see the ocean freeze.
Yep, you can.
Wow. So let's talk about the narrative of the book, because, you know, this is a novel. The timeline is sort of like today's movies. There's a fair amount of jumping around. I mean, how was that decided upon to go with that approach?
Well, I wanted to begin by getting the shipwreck out there. And that was a deliberate choice, in part because as a reader, I enjoy that. I enjoy having something coming and knowing it's coming and seeing how we get there. I think it's suspenseful, and I was hopeful that it would engage readers as well. But it also speaks to the inevitability of what happens in terms of, you know, the possibility that it could happen, the inevitability of what's going on in the continent. So I wanted to put it out there right away. And then it seemed natural to just build on that and to use separate sections for Deb's past and her history with Keller and her, you know, rise as a scientist. I worked with working it into the narrative, but then decided it worked better to separate it out a little bit and do flashbacks.
Speaking of the flashbacks, there's sex in a dark room at some point here. Need not say who. Having spent some time in dark rooms, I mean, there's a red light, but that's about the sexiest thing about it. I mean, do you really think someone would have hot sex in a place where you could end up in the fixer bath?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, Deb is impulsive. She's,
We gave it away. It's Deb.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, she's impulsive. Didn't mean to give that away. But it's one of the many things that she does that doesn't make a lot of sense probably to most people. She's also, you know, she grew up not belonging. And that's one reason she feels so at home in Antarctica, because it doesn't matter down there. You're away from everything. Animals don't care. She feels very much at home there. And so I think that scene and the relationship she was having at the time of the dark room scene just reflected how she was, you know, trying to fit in and trying to be a part of something that she never really could be a part of.
Darkroom scene at the University of Missouri, is that right?
That's right.
Well, what do you know? My alma mater, too.
I hope that didn't conjure up any really strange images
nope,
for you.
Nothing like that happened to me. I can assure you that. So you, how fun was that then to write Deb Gardner? Because you've got this person who's, you know, she's a scientist, so everything's about facts and things that lead to facts. And we test the hypothesis, and that didn't work. Therefore, that's out of the picture. And yet, with her personal social behavior, There's no taking of steps or you know, care or a lot. I mean, there's a lot of the things that happen in science just don't happen in her personal life.
Exactly. Well, she's a different sort of scientist, in fact, because most of the scientists that I met when I was helping at Punta Tumbo in Argentina and the ones I met on the ship there, when it comes to the research that they do, they care deeply about the penguins, but they are also practical, and they have a bit of distance that Deb does not have when it comes to the penguins. I think if you are a scientist and you study these animals over years and decades. You have to accept the sad news of what's happening to them. You have to accept you have to look at a lot of dead penguins and be okay with that. And it's not easy work, but I think most scientists have a certain detachment that allows them to do that work, whereas Deb doesn't. She's got an emotional sort of soft spot around her sort of icy core. She's got a really soft spot for the birds. And, you know, that emotional spot is what leads to these other things in her personal life.
So your own work in Argentina, then, as you mentioned, working with the penguins, I mean, where did you fall in that spectrum of, like, keeping some distance and having a soft spot?
Well, I was a volunteer for only a few weeks, so mm-hmm. it was a very short time there. And it was hard to see dead penguins, and it was hard to see, you know, penguins that, even penguins that didn't find mates. I would say, that penguin looks lonely. You know, I am just, I really project onto the animals, which scientists don't do. And so I don't think I could ever be a scientist. I'm not cut out for that sort of work. But I could see how they worked, and I have so much respect for them and how they care so deeply and want to do so much, and yet they're able to do their job in a rational way. But it was, I think it would be very hard job for me to do, but for a week it was mostly just enlightening and fascinating.
Were you just out with a clipboard and writing down numbers?
Yeah, they had a specific way that we had to do it, very scientific. And yeah, you counted within a certain, I think it was a 5-meter diameter circle, you would count the nests and the number of penguins in the nests and the number of eggs if they had eggs, and, you know, pairs versus single birds. And
so did you get to see penguins of different, you know, in very different stages of life? You know, little fuzzy guys?
Oh, no, I wish. Yeah. This was mostly the breeding season early in the breeding season where they were just getting together and laying eggs. So we didn't see chicks. It was too early for that, but we saw a lot of eggs and some mating dances and stuff like that.
Do all penguin species mate for life, or do some of them?
No, it varies.
Really?
Some mate for life. Some are more loyal to their nest sites than their mates. So if they go back, they always go back to the same nest sites. And Magellanics are very loyal to their nest sites. They always like to go back. And if something happens, if a rainstorm collapses their burrow, they'll rebuild it. They will go back there, but if their mate doesn't show up, they'll choose a new one. So it varies quite a lot. They try to stay faithful, are usually monogamous for a season, but then the instinct takes over, and if their mate doesn't show up, they decide to move on.
Okay, well, I'm sure you got the house, so what the heck? I'll just find a new mate.
I've got the house. I'll find a new partner.
You've mentioned rain a couple of times now, and you did mention that on the Antarctic Peninsula, it does get to be a bit warmer, a little more temperate in the summer of Antarctica. Does it rain often and generally just on the peninsula?
In the peninsula, it does. In the summer, we did experience some rain. It was mostly sleet, like very icy rain. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it does.
You basically say in the beginning of the book, there's going to be a lot of loss in the book. Is the warning necessary? I mean, people are going to expect some ups and downs in any novel, aren't they?
I suppose they are.
So as you set out to write My Last Continent, were you trying to give some education, some inspiration, entertainment?
Well,
anything?
My job as a writer is first and foremost to entertain. So I hope that I've achieved that. And beyond that, absolutely, I hope people fall in love with penguins. I hope they fall in love with Antarctica. I hope they, you know, hope they learn more. And I hope they also make the connection between what we do up here and how we treat the planet and how much it affects everything at the bottom of the world. Because I think that connection, it's such a remote place that it's hard to believe that so much of what we do here can affect the Southern Hemisphere. But it really does.
Was that connection immediately apparent to you on your trip to Antarctica? The idea that the stuff we do thousands of miles north of there is still going to do something to what happens to the creatures down here?
Well, I made the connection, and I think the naturalists that we had on our cruise did a great job of it as well. Because, you know, you have to realize that everything is connected in terms of, they talked a lot about the ecosystem in the Southern Ocean, but of course all the oceans are connected, and especially down there. You know, we went through the Drake Passage, which is the most violent sea I've ever been through and probably ever will be again, but the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Southern Ocean all meet there. And so this is a place where a lot's going on, and the ecosystem is quite fragile though with climate change. Any sort of temperature modifications affect everything. And of course, the atmosphere up here has a lot. We know about the ozone layer, you know, everything. I made the connection very, very early. And I'm not sure everyone does. I think you have to go into it with sort of an open mind. And some travelers do and some don't. So, you know, my hope is that the people who are going, among the 40,000 people a year who do go, that they're all thinking open-mindedly about it.
How scary was that moment of the Drake Passage? And did you have any other things that felt like, oh, my God, I'm going to die on this trip to Antarctica?
It wasn't scary in terms of thinking I would capsize, although I've heard stories about really, really awful trips through the Drake. Fortunately, ours wasn't like that. But I just couldn't get out of bed for 2 days. I just felt too seasick.
Oh, really?
I just couldn't move. Yeah. And a lot of people couldn't move. So it's very common. I think the swells were maybe 10 or 15 feet or something, which doesn't sound like a lot. But when you're in it, it's quite bumpy.
Depends on the size of the ship, too, doesn't it?
That's true. We had a very small ship, and it had stabilizers. But it's still a small boat, yeah.
Not stable enough, as
yeah,
it turned
exactly.
out. I've noticed in some of the publicity work that you've been doing for my last content, you've been traveling around with a stuffed penguin.
Yes.
Tell us about, is that Admiral Byrd?
I call him Admiral Byrd. My dear friend Marilyn gave him to me as a gift a week before the book tour started, and I decided since I was traveling on my own, I would take him with me. I'm not into taking selfies. I don't do that. But I wanted to be able to do some stuff for social media. You know, I wanted to be able to have some fun on the tour, so I took Admiral Byrd with me, and he just photobombs all my pictures.
And so where have you been so far to support the book?
I've been to Boston and New York. And this week, I'm headed to Portland and Seattle. And a week or so after that, I'm headed to Southern California, where I have several events there. And then in the fall, I'm going to Australia. The book is being published in several foreign countries, and Australia is among them. So I'm going to go for a writer's festival over there in Brisbane.
Congratulations.
Thank
all the success.
You.
Tonight at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland from 7 to 8. And then, it must affirm your belief in publishing and in books to not just write this book and be the co-founder of Ashland Creek Press, but to see the way people have come out to see you and respond to the book.
It's been wonderful. I am so grateful and so excited to be able to talk about it and to reach every single reader. Every single reader matters. And it's really, I think most authors appreciate that. But I especially do as someone who's written for a long time, who's written mostly short stories, who is a publisher myself. You know, every reader is wonderful, and we're grateful to each one. And it's been so fun to go out and meet them.
Are you continuing to write? I mean, are you always writing in addition to all the other things you do in your life?
I try. I really do. It's been pretty crazy lately. But in general, I try to spend a little time, if not every day, every week. One thing, as soon as I finished this novel and got it out off my plate, I started writing short stories again because I just wanted to do something I could finish in less than 2 years, you know, just wanted to get something done. So I've been working on short stories lately and then sort of gathering information for my next novel, which I'm excited about.
All right. Midge Raymond is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book, her debut novel, is called My Last Continent, out on Scribner. She'll be tonight at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland at 7 o'clock, and you can meet her there. And I want to thank you for joining us on the Exchange today.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Good to have you.